Good afternoon, everybody.
Okay, it is now.
Sorry, so Ray, I'll do a brief intro, and I'll let you know when we'll start the webinar. So thank you, everyone, for joining our webinar today entitled An Introduction to International Health, an Interdisciplinary Perspective. We will please note that your phones and microphones have been muted to eliminate background noise. If you have any problems with your audio, please do let us know and we'll try to assist you by typing your issue in the chat box or question box. My name is T. Din, and I'm the current Vice President of the Canadian Society for Epidemiology and Biostatistics. On behalf of the CSEB, I am pleased to see so many participants today. We have a record number of participants for any one of our webinar offerings, so that's great. I'm also grateful to Dr. Ray Wat-Dionandan, who is also a board member of the CSEB, for delivering this webinar today. Today's webinar will be 1 hour in length, including a question and answer period at the end. To ask a question, you have two options. First, you can raise your hand by using the icon on the left side of your participant panel. Click on Raise Your Hand, and I will unmute you during the Q&A period. If your hand is raised, it means that you want to ask a question via audio. Please be sure to unraise your hand if you do not intend to ask a question. Secondly, if you'd prefer to write in your question, you can do so using the question box on the control panel. We suggest you ask your question to the entire audience in order to avoid redundancy. I'm very pleased to introduce our presenter today, Dr. Ray Wat-Dionandan. He is an epidemiologist, author, journalist, and global health specialist. He is currently an assistant professor in the Faculty of Health Sciences and formerly the chief scientific advisor to the Canadian Federal Agency on Assisted Human Reproduction in Canada. The 2000 recipient of the National Book Award of the Nation of Guyana, Dr. Dionandan seeks to incorporate genuine interdisciplinarity into his work in the health sciences, exploring seemingly disparate but actual interrelated topics in global disease burden, statistics, history, ethics, law, communication, and policy, social policy. Dr. Dionandan currently sits on the board of directors of both Harbourfront Centre in Toronto and the Canadian Society for Epidemiology and Biostatistics. He is the former editor of the CSEB National Newsletter and maintains a regular blog with the Huffington Post Canada. He is also the founder, academic advisor, and executive editor of the Interdisciplinary Journal of Health Sciences, the peer-reviewed journal of the students of the Interdisciplinary School of Health Sciences. Now, without further ado, over to you, Dr. Dionandan.
Was quite the mouthful of an introduction. So this is very exciting that we've entered the 21st century. We get to do this sort of inclusive electronic education. And I see that of the large number of people signed up for this webinar, a fairly large proportion are in fact former or current students of mine. So for you, it may be a bit of a review of the things that we've covered before in class. And for those of you who have not been my student in the past, hopefully we have a fruitful conversation. There's a lot of stuff to cover today. I want to begin by, by plugging my textbook, the book that gives its name to this webinar. You don't need to buy it, obviously, but if you want to know more in depth what we are discussing today, I've covered most of it in this particular book. You can get it from that website. We have explored with the publisher the opportunity to maybe reduce the cost for people who are signed up for this webinar, and if that happens, we will let you know via email. But if not, you're free to go there and buy it now, and if not, that's okay. I don't really need the money. Now, I have a lot of slides. I have like 80 slides, and they're jam-packed with information, and I won't get to all of them. I'm going to zip through a lot of stuff, and so don't be overwhelmed if you see a slide come and go very fast. That's okay. I just use the slides as props to talk. But I want to start by asking you that when people say international health, what do you think they think of first? What pops into their mind first? I submit that what pops into their mind is this, an image of, frankly, poor, starving children, usually dark-skinned and usually African. And the reason for that is that this is the image we get from Sunday afternoon infomercials, right? And this has sort of framed how we think about international slash global health. And what I want to submit to you is the possibility that this topic transcends this very simplistic view. I want to point out that health disparities exist in the strangest places, local places. What we talk about today doesn't have to be an international topic. There are gaps between rich and poor right here in Canada. There are nations within nations, and there are gender issues within each nation too, all of which are global slash international health issues. In this slide, I point out that even in Canada, the gap between rich and poor is enormous and widening. So, and this is the essence of the disparities we see globally. So if you want to do international health work, you can do it domestically as well. And in this slide, I point out that we can't forget that we have within our nation another nation, the First Nations. There's something called the Human Development Scale, and Canada always ranks very highly on this scale. We rank number 4 currently, and it's a combination of educational opportunity, living standards, wealth, etc. If we looked at just our Aboriginal communities, they'd be ranked number 78 beneath Kazakhstan. So always remember, we have issues right here domestically. We don't need to look abroad to look for things to address. I like to begin these types of talks with a simple question. What causes malaria? And most people will tell you that malaria is caused by the Plasmodium parasite or mosquitoes or an inability to get rid of mosquitoes. And then the more you step back from this question, the more you realize that there are all sorts of factors that are giving rise to the epidemic of malaria. And very quickly, one lands on the conclusion that maybe poverty is the fundamental pillar that underlines a lot of these big diseases, these big health disparity issues. So it's inappropriate to simply tackle this problem from strictly a medical perspective. We have to look at it from a financial, an economic, and historical, a social perspective as well. Before we go on, I think it's important to look at some terminology. I've used the terms global health and international health rather interchangeably, and I'll continue to use them interchangeably, but technically they mean different things. And there are some sticklers among you who will give me a pointing out that there's a difference. So here's the difference. A lot of scholars will tell you that global health talks about the commonality between people. So obesity and diabetes are global pandemics. These are issues of global health. International health stresses the differences between countries. So that's a low-income country. This is how they differ. It really doesn't matter. But be aware that there is a distinction according to some scholars. I will not be making this distinction. I think it's ultimately unproductive. Another important thing to remember is what to call poorer countries. Traditionally, we call them the third world, and that's a passé sort of terminology. It goes back to the Cold War. Some people call it the developing world, but what does that even mean? Is China a developing country? Is India a developing country? China is the second wealthiest, at least in terms of expanding economies, country in the world, and yet one can perceive China as being somewhat of a developing country. What about the global south? You've probably heard that term before as well. Global South refers to the fact that a lot of the poorer countries in the world are in fact in the southern hemisphere. But Australia and New Zealand are not poor countries, so that's kind of not appropriate either. So these days, a lot of people refer to low and middle income countries, LMICs. So a low income country would be Chad or Mali or Rwanda. A middle income country would be South Africa or Brazil, possibly, up and coming economies. And that's not to say that we haven't got international health issues in wealthy countries as well. But if we're choosing or seeking to separate out the world in terms of these issues, then a convenient way of doing so is to draw a bright line between high income and everybody else. So today, given that we haven't got a lot of time, I'm only going to talk about really three big topics. The history of global health, the institutions that are pertinent for you to know about if you're a student of this topic and maybe if you want to do some research on this topic or speak authoritatively in this topic. And lastly, some of the tools that are relevant for epidemiologists. And frankly, I'm not going to give a lot of weight to the tools, even though that's the most useful part of this, because most of you are epidemiologists and you'll already have had some grounding in the instrumentation of this and maybe not so much background in the history and the philosophies underpinning international health. So let's start with history. And yes, that's a picture of Michael Jackson. And no, I'm not talking about Michael Jackson. I was looking for an image to convey the idea of history. Many people would say that this is an example of the first international health crisis. What it is, it's a depiction of the Spaniards arriving in the New World in the 15th century. And this was a case of two vastly separated people, geographically, historically, culturally, economically, and technologically, and that resulted in pretty much the extermination of one people, right? And if you don't realize it, the extermination of the Aboriginals of the New World was due in large part to diseases. It wasn't entirely due to directed conquest. And one of the questions that many theorists have struggled with since then is, why did Native Americans die from European diseases, but Europeans did not die from American diseases? There are all sorts of theories why that might be. If you ever read Guns, Germs, and Steel, it gives a fairly cogent description of the prevailing theories right now. And I won't go into this too deeply, but recognize that this is an example of international slash global health. But we can draw upon examples going back thousands of years before then, when Greek sailors encountered Asian communities, and there were episodes of sharing of diseases there as well. So there is no bright line that determines the origins of international slash global health. But in the modern era, a way to think about it is to think about what the definition of health is. And all of you are students of health sciences to some degree, and you've probably heard the WHO definition. And that is, health is a state of complete physical, mental, and social well-being, and not merely the absence of disease or infirmity. This is a really important definition for a lot of reasons. Most importantly for international health is that it opens the door. Opens the door to what? It opens the door to considering other things that may not be immediately medical to be relevant to health. So is it unhealthy to live in a tyranny rather than a democracy? Is it unhealthy to live in a society with an insufficient number of women, for example? These are demographic and political and economic questions, not necessarily medical questions. But because of our wide definition of health, we have accepted that now things that aren't overtly medical are now relevant to health and therefore international health. Okay, so a couple of quotes here. One is from Paul Farmer. He's a hero in global health. And he says, the identification of global health issues is constrained by social and political forces with roots in the 19th century. This suggests that to understand problems today, we need to know what happened at least 100 years ago, probably longer than that. Unite for Sight, which is a big international health conference at Yale, puts this on their website. Although most global health workers are not historians, all should recognize the importance of historical factors in contemporary health. I can't stress this enough. If I had a couple more hours, I'd talk more about the reasons for this, having to do with how we conceptualize the nature and the role of caregivers internationally has a lot to do with the imperial persona, the modern-day neo-colonial perspective that development workers often embrace unconsciously, and that springs from a history of colonialism and conquest and oppression. And that brings us to the obvious question, and that is, why is the third world the third world? I already said I don't like the term the third world. This slide is taken from another presentation, not by me, and it's a question that was asked a long time ago by some serious scholars. And it's a complicated question. And the reason has to do with a lot of interlapping factors. I have a list of them in this slide here. Wealth disparity really is the crux underlining why some populations and some countries are poor, and some populations in some countries are not that poor. Among them are the brain drain, that's the movement of people away from a country, debt, crippling debt, a lack of natural resources having to do with history of exploitation, military overspending, corruption. And two things here that I'm going to take some time to explore. One is colonialism, and the other is a cash crop agriculture. Colonialism, if you don't know, is the idea of one population or nation exerting direct control over another. And colonialism goes back thousands of years. When we talk about today, though, we're talking about European colonialism that emerged in the last 500 years, when the European powers held hegemony over non-European countries. Right? And the controversy is to what extent is colonialism still responsible for wealth disparities today, even though the age of colonialism is done. And a quick history here is that what we consider to be European colonialism began in the 15th century, and then that led to the industrial age in the 19th century, and then slowly the era of decolonialization in the 20th century. that led to a series of independent nations today that still have colonial legacies of dependency and struggle. Colonialism leads to a number of bad things. The brain drain I mentioned, which is the sucking of talented people from colonies to the mother country. Corruption that's caused by history of decapitation of leaders. By decapitation, I don't mean cutting off the heads, I mean the removal of leaders. Capitalism, which is not overtly a bad thing, but leads to the imbalanced, unfair trade relationships that have sucked wealth out of the nation, and environmental degradation. So one of the factors or methods by which colonialism led to destabilization and poor health was through the redrawing of borders. So one example of this is the Conference of Berlin in 1884, where all of the African borders were redrawn by European powers. Here's a map of Africa in 1902 after the Conference of Berlin, and you see that all of the great powers have redrawn chunks of Africa according to their political need, and these borders transcend or cut across tribal lands, geographical zones, environmental zones, and so forth, that cause a whole bunch of conflicts between historical peoples that were living, you know, somewhat peaceably for generations, that created some strange zoning irregularities leading to ecological problems, and things like that. Then we have the problem of cash crops. So the great powers remade many of these countries as providers of certain resources. Cash crops are things like sugar and coffee, or minerals that you can't eat, right? You create them for export purposes. What this ends up doing is it reduces the nation's ability to produce food for itself and creates a dependency on imports. And this, in the long run, over many generations, creates diminishing wealth and diminishing health. Here, this little graphic shows us the flow of goods from Africa to Europe. So raw materials from Africa were sent to Europe where they're processed into goods. For example, timber is processed into furniture and resold to Africa at inflated prices. And so the cycle is that gradually wealth is sucked out of Africa. Okay. The results of a cash crop economy is that you end up with no more local farms. You end up with limited nutritional diversity, and you end up with megalithic companies that are running food production and slowly sucking wealth out of the population. So the takeaway message here is that today's agriculture is a reflection of trading policies that are 200 to 300 years old. So today, some countries still make those same products that their colonial overseers had them create generations ago. So they haven't really come out of the shackles of colonialism yet. And this is reflected in their inability to produce sufficient wealth to get themselves out of difficult situations. Let's jump ahead several decades now to World War II. Because some interesting images from World War II. World War II was obviously a globe-shaking event. And an interesting thing happened at the end of World War II. An economic golden age emerged. So industrialized economies grew very, very fast. There were lots of prosperity being brought about. And there's also an interest in using this prosperity to fix the perceived problems of the world that led to the war in the first place. So in 1947, there was a cholera epidemic in Egypt that killed about 20,000 people. And that spurred the world to organize, to use their new technologies, their new wealth, their new organization. Because remember, the war was won on technology, wealth, and organization. And that same philosophy was going to take them into the 20th century. So the WHO and NATO were founded at the same time. NATO to control the world security, at least from a Western perspective, and the WHO to control the world health, also from a top-down technological perspective. This is a quote from Harry Truman, the U.S. president, at the founding of NATO. And the important part here is in the red. He says, "For the first time in history, humanity possesses the knowledge and skill to relieve the suffering of these people." And by these people, he means the poor and the dispossessed of the world. So they're going to use the same mentality, the same technologies, the same approach, the same interventions, the same sort of we can do it attitude to quote unquote fix the world's problems. It sounds great. The problem is that what won a war is not going to be the best way to change the world's health profile. As an example, I give you malaria control. So the Global Malaria Eradication Program began in 1955, and it took the same approach that World War II took. fact, they use military tools to do so, with DDT and chloroquine. The problem there is you created all sorts of resistance. And in fact, there wasn't a lot of buy-in from the populations being affected. This was done from the top down. And as a result, we have an evolution from a malaria eradication program to a malaria control program. And that gives us the separation of two kinds of international health programs. The first we call vertical, and the second called horizontal. A vertical program is one that comes from on high. There's external funding, it's directed, it's got a single objective, it's probably a little bit imperialistic, and horizontal, rather, it has more buy-in, involves more stakeholders, and probably is cheaper. So both have their pros and cons, and this graphic shows us a summary of the pros and cons of vertical versus horizontal programs. But if you get into this field, this will become part of your lexicon, understanding the differences between vertical and horizontal programs, because that's the way the money is spent, that's the way the programs are organized. But recognize it comes from historical attempts, failed attempts, to change the world for the better. Now, in the 70s, the vertical programs started to be criticized a bit more vociferously, and the Western model of top-down care just wasn't working in many parts of the world. And we looked at something called the Chinese Barefoot Doctor Program. And in China, they had a program of sending villagers into the unserviced areas with some minimal medical care. And these barefoot doctors would give basic medical care, and that seemed to have a profound change in the overall population health. So we didn't need these expensive, top-down, vertical, really high technology interventions to make change. You needed people on the ground doing small things to make change. And that led to something called the Alma-Ata Declaration in 1978, where primary health care was thought to be one of the most important endeavors to embrace to change the world health. So one phrase you may hear a lot when it comes to development and international health is a rising tide lifts all boats. This is an economic statement. What it refers to is that if you make a population wealthy, then everybody will benefit. It isn't true, but it can be true. And this has led to or neoliberalism, as it's called, to leverage the free market to increase wealth with the assumption that increasing wealth will result in increasing health. So this is a neoliberal philosophy that dominates what we do today in international health and international development. Right? So it argues that the free market is a better tool for growth than direct intervention, and that leads us to things called structural adjustments. A structural adjustment is when we mess with a nation's economy to bring about positive change. And these adjustments include things like devaluing the currency, right? Reducing how much something can buy. And the reason you do that is it makes their exports more attractive. We increase privatization. Why? Because the assumption is that private individuals can manage services better than governments. We deregulate in order to reduce the barriers to trade and things like that. Now, this is a political position, but this is what dominates the discourse today in development and health. So, which brings us to the pertinent institutions. Who's doing all this? Who do you work with if you are an international health and development worker? Who are these organizations that are espousing these beliefs and putting forth perhaps philosophically and politically based agendas to make positive change? At the end of World War II, again, the world was broken. There was wealth, there was power, there's authority and hope, and the great powers, those who world, for the better they fought. Okay, you can watch this YouTube clip if you want to see a meeting that took place in Bretton Woods, New Hampshire. And this meeting brought about a lot of institutional change, including the creation of two institutions. One is called the World Bank, and the World Bank issues low-interest loans, or no-interest loans, to developing nations. IBRD and IDA are two institutions within the World Bank. If you want to see their member countries, go to the link here. And the IMF. The IMF is the International Monetary Fund, and they also invest in changing economies. They look at the economy as a whole, not on projects per se. Now, the difference between the World Bank and the IMF is this. The World Bank finances economic development by funding large projects. The IMF seeks to oversee financial good behavior. Okay, so these two institutions together really constitute the major sources of debt in the world, for better or worse, for many poor nations, right? And there are political debates over whether or not they do good or they do bad. And I'm not going to say which side I'm on. I'm simply presenting the facts, and you can make up your own mind. But this is the philosophy of the institutions that dominate the discourse right now in the world. Other organizations include the Red Cross, you've probably heard of. I won't go too deeply into the Red Cross right now. Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders, are the big champions of international health. And as epidemiologists, I'm sure you're all curious about perhaps doing work with Doctors Without Borders. They were founded after the Biafran Civil War. And their job, or their mandate, or their agenda, in absence of any political perspective. So they won't judge a government, and they won't take a side in a conflict. They will just be there to give care to civilians. But even they aren't without criticisms. So there's something called MSF syndrome, and that's when the provision of care by this NGO takes away the motivation of a people to rise up against an oppressor, or maybe takes away the responsibility of a government to give that same care. So nothing is without criticism. Okay. WHO, I mentioned, is the major institution responsible for the health of the world, and it's a megalith. In Canada, we have something called CETA, the Canadian International Development Agency, but lately CETA was absorbed by Foreign Affairs Canada, and that's still evolving. And the USA has USAID, United States Agency for International Development. Their major international health project in Africa was something called PEPFAR, the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, which has really changed the face of African health quite remarkably. And it may shock you to know that in parts of Africa, George Bush is considered a hero. That's because he's the one who started PEPFAR. And his name's attached to most of the positive change regarding HIV/AIDS in sub-Saharan Africa. The Global Fund was put forth in 2002 as a result of an article by Jeffrey Sachs and Amir Adaran. And their goal is to fund change of directed at certain diseases based upon performance. So it's evaluation focused. And here's where the epidemiology comes in, because without epidemiology, we can't measure outcome and impact. So that's always missing in a lot of these interventions, is how do we measure success. Gates Foundation is important. Gates Foundation is actually wealthier than the WHO. It is the wealthiest NGO in the world, I think. And they are doing remarkable things right now on vaccine development and, again, on HIV. And there's Clinton Foundation, also focused on HIV/AIDS. Yes, that's a composite image of Bill and Hillary. So the problem with the global health funding bodies is that they're fragmented, there's overlap, there's their agenda strewn, and there's very poor evaluation strategies. So the epidemiology becomes more and more important, how to measure outcome and impact. Right. Now, in 2000, a summit was held by the UN to agree upon certain goals that we as a race would try to reach in the next few decades. And this was the UN02, the Millennium Development Goals, MDGs. And here are the 8 goals. I won't go through them. Just be aware that if you're going to go into this field, this is really the crux of how to approach the field now. So the goals have given us a framework for devising strategies and for evaluating strategies and for thinking about policy. So please take some time to look at these 8 on your own time later on if you're curious about this field, because this really is the foundation for the philosophy, the philosophical interventions and the path forward for the next few decades. All right, let's move on to the last part of today's presentation. That is the epidemiology, the tools, the indicators necessary for understanding and evaluating and measuring global health. So before I get there, let me ask you this. Are these countries poor? Brazil, Russia, India, and China? These are the BRIC countries. You've heard of that, right? BRIC. I don't know why they call them BRIC. Why not CRIB? CRIB is a better word. anyway. Sometimes South Africa is thrown in there, sometimes Korea is thrown in as well. So these are up-and-coming emerging economies that may be the wealthiest nations in the next 100 years. But they are considered to be targets for development now. And this brings up the question of how do we measure or determine need for investment and need for development and need for wealth, right? Because China, the second fastest growing economy in the world, the second biggest economy in the world, and India has more billionaires than we do. So what constitutes poor? It's hard to say. So here's a map showing the GDP per capita. GDP is a gross domestic product, so a measurement of wealth. And the more blue, the wealthier. Well, that's interesting, isn't it? We see that, in fact, India and China really aren't among the club of the blue yet. That's because even though there's a lot of wealth there, it's not well distributed and there's an enormous population left to support. That is why they're still considered to be struggling and developing and emerging nations. Who are the richest people in the world? Well, here they are. This is from Forbes magazine, right? And I won't go through this list, but the important part here is that they are not all in the USA or the Western world anymore. The richest man in the world is in Mexico. India has more billionaires than Canada does. Where are the Canadian billionaires? Well, 35 made the list, but they're not in the top 20, that's for sure. Now, is Canada therefore a half country? Well, yes, but the wealth is not as compressed and as focused as it is in other countries. So, jumping around here. Here are the leading causes of death in children under 5. Right? Something hopefully jumps out at you about these diseases, and that something is that they're all preventable, they're all manageable, and our inability to focus resources is preventing us from managing these diseases. So I showed you that off scales were measurements of economic development. So imagine you're the nation of Dionandia, where I am the king, and you are all my ministers of health. And I tell you that we haven't got a lot of money, but we have three diseases, cooties, malaria, and diabetes. And I ask you, where should I spend my money? And you have to give me an answer. You're going to make your answer based upon some kind of measurement. And that measurement will be an indicator. It may be who's dying the most. It may be how many people are affected. It may be how many young people are affected, because we tend to value the young more than the old. Right? So an indicator is just a statistical value that provides a direction. Right? It's just a number. Blah, blah, blah. It's just a number. And the important part here is that indicators are needed to monitor the extent to which certain health conditions are affecting the population. They're needed to monitor the extent to which programs are succeeding as a kind of baseline versus progress measurement. And they're needed to inform decision making. It's really easy to choose the wrong indicator. So it really depends on what you mean to measure. What's it costing? What's the fastest growing disease? How many are suffering? Who's suffering? How you define suffering, right? So looking at the impact of disease is a science and an art unto itself. It requires a nuanced and subtle brain to consider what are the important factors that represent our personal values when it comes to assessing change and impact. So some of the pragmatic aspects of indicator use can be summarized in these four criteria here. So an indicator should be well defined. It should be valid, you know that term from epidemiology. It should be feasible. For example, I may want to say, well, all I care about is are my people happy? But how do I measure happy? Is it feasible to measure happiness? Right? Can I ask everyone, are you happy? It's not a feasible kind of thing to do. Is there utility in this? Right, so I may decide to measure happiness, but how's that going to affect my decision making? How can I incorporate that into my policy making? So unless these four criteria are upheld, then an indicator can be quite useless. Canada's approach is to categorize indicators into five categories. The first is health status, so that's how many people are sick. Second is non-medical determinants, so in other words, how many are smoking, right? Because smoking is a behavior, it's not a clinical outcome. Health system performance, what's our waiting list scenario like? Community and health system characteristics are things like population density. And lastly, this thing called equity, which is very Canadian. And by equity, I mean something like if we were to remove this disease, how many people would get better at a rate similar to people in that community there who don't have the disease, as a way to equivalate, is that a word? I guess so, the health status of different kinds of people. All right, so if you go on Health Canada's website, look up indicators, you'll see them categorized in these broad categories. So as I'm running out of time, the broad epidemiological tools tend to be these things here. So poverty is a topic I can talk about for two hours. Poverty can be considered relative or absolute, right? So are we as poor as India? No, we are not. But someone living under the poverty line here would be a wealthy person in India. That doesn't mean that person is not impoverished in Canada. That's a relative measure. The European Union defines poverty as living beneath 60% of the median income, right? So a relative measure always guarantees that someone is going to be poor. Even in a society of millionaires, someone is going to be poor by definition. Absolute poverty, on the other hand, has to do with, do you have the basics of life? Do you have rent? Do you have food? Do you have health care? Mortality, we all know about mortality for epidemiology, crude mortality, proportionate mortality rates, case fatality rates, and so forth. Morbidity, we all know about that as well, prevalence and incidence. The MMR and IMR are critical. MMR is the maternal mortality rate. That's the number of women dying as a result of childbirth, usually given as a rate per number of live births. And the infant mortality rate, infant being someone under 1 year of age. These two measurements are critical for assessing the quality of a healthcare system because they are, again, preventable in large part. Maternal deaths are usually caused by lack of antenatal care and lack of a certain kind of drug intervention that are quite simple to give. So an inability to protect these two groups shows a fundamental failing in a nation's healthcare system. So it's a wonderful, though heartbreaking, way of measuring progress as a society in health evolution. Life expectancy is a fun one. We tend to use it as our go-to measurement of health, but it's problematic for a number of reasons, one of which is that a long-lived population is not necessarily a healthy population or a happy population or an economically productive population. And lastly, the daily. The daily is the disability-adjusted life year. And I'm sure a lot of you know what that is already, but if you don't, I'll just quickly say that it's a combination of death and disability. And the power of the daily is that for the first time, it brings to the table the discussion of diseases that don't kill you, but that really make you miserable. What kind of diseases? Well, how about things like mental illness? Mental illness enters the conversation now because of the daily, right? So most mental illness issues don't kill you, but they make you profoundly unhappy and unproductive in life. And it's important for us to be able to measure and quantify those kinds of effects relative to other health issues such that they can be targeted. So this graph here shows us the distribution of MMR issues around the world. Unsurprisingly, they tend to be clustered in sub-Saharan Africa, which is the focus of most of the world's ills, unfortunately. And I love showing this graph. I show it every opportunity I can. This shows the number of cases, in other words, incidence cases, of AIDS from 1990 to 2000 in three different areas. In North America, mostly due to the arrival of ARV medication, and the Caribbean, it went up dramatically. And I always ask students, what happened in the Caribbean that caused this spike in new AIDS cases? And they will say things like, oh, there are people moving into the region, or there's more unsafe sex or something. And frankly, the real reason is that a surveillance system was put into place in the early 90s, and that has artificially increased the number of perceived cases. So the number of cases probably always been high. It's just that now we're seeing them. We call that detection bias, as you probably know. So these kinds of biases are critical in understanding. There are lots of indicators out there. You can go to the WHO website and look up their core health indicators. There are thousands of them. You can go to the Center for Global Development to look up their new indicators. Here's a quick study that I did a number of years ago. I looked at indicators of female empowerment from the WHO database and try to determine if it's possible to predict which Arab country would revolt next. This is during the Arab Spring. this is an ecological study, it's pretty weak, but we have this straight line here. So we found that the ratio of women to men was a predictor of whether or not a nation was likely to revolt during the Arab Spring phenomenon. Interesting, huh? So indicators can be used in creative fashions to extract some degree of wisdom from otherwise confusing scenarios. This graph tells a life expectancy story really powerfully, I think. And it comes down to this, is that the gains in life expectancy of the last 100 years don't have to do with lifespan as much as they have to do with improvements in infant mortality. If you look at 1850 here, at birth, your life expectancy was 40. At 70, your life expectancy was 80. Jump ahead to 2000, at birth, your life expectancy was close to 70. But at 70, your life expectancy was just over 80. So if you're already old, you really haven't gained a lot in the last 100 years. But if you're really young, you've gained a hell of a lot. What this tells us, by the way, this is American population, right? It looks like a third world country, but no, it's American population. So what this tells us is that it's fairly easy to increase life expectancy in struggling nations that don't have good child care. This is why, again, we focus so heavily on infant mortality rates. Now, the Daily has allowed us to look at the shifts in the burdens of disease around the world. This graph shows us leading causes of burden of disease measured in dailies from 2004 to what they're projected to be in 2030. So currently, lower respiratory infections are the biggest problem. By 2030, they'll be number six. Depressive disorders, unipolar depression, is number three. They're expected to be number one in another 15 years or so. Right? So that's how important dailies are in understanding the growth and the spread and the change of ill health around the world. This is my last slide, because I want to leave some time for conversation and for questions here. And I'm just going to project into the future where the growth areas are in global / international health research. Without a doubt, information technology is critical. I've mentioned something called the digital divide here. So there are those people who have access to the internet and those who do not. And those who have access are jumping ahead in leaps and bounds in terms of economic development and educational opportunities. And those without access are being held behind at a faster rate. So the ways in which we look at information technology as a vector for change and as a tool for disease surveillance is hot. Demographic change. There are some profound demographic changes happening in India and China and some other countries, having mostly to do with gender differences. And here in Ontario, we're probably going to see a strange phenomenon soon where young boys are being left behind in larger numbers. And what's that going to do to our economic profile and to our crime rates and things like that? That's all speculative, but it's interesting. The growth of middle-income countries and what their needs are is fascinating. So India, as their middle class expands and increases, their dietary habits are changing. Meat consumption is increasing in India. And as a result, the price of food is going up. Ecological damage is going up. Diabetes and obesity rates are going up. So that's creating all sorts of interesting changes and fascinating opportunities for research. Climate change, of course, is the big issue that's going to affect the entire planet for the foreseeable future. Urban health, an important thing happened about 4 years ago. For the first time in human history, more people live in cities than they do in rural areas. And so the human animal is now a city-dwelling animal. And that has to be the focus of our concern going forward. Mental health. As I mentioned, with the advent of the daily has come the ascension of mental health issues as the predominant concern globally. We don't know how to measure it, let alone deal with it. So epidemiologists can step in and show us how to measure this better, what tools are available. And lastly, globalization. What is globalization? It's the breaking down of trade and travel barriers between nations. So in many ways, an educated person in Mali has more in common with an educated person in North America than he or she does with his less educated person next door. All right? So we have communities forming transnationally. We have companies that are transnational. We have the flow of disease vectors and of opportunity that is global and not domestic. And what does that mean for how we fund projects, how we think about projects, how we measure projects, and how we intervene in people's health is going to be interesting in the next couple of decades. So I'll end it there. I think I've spoken a lot. and I will ask you to ask me any questions. So I would prefer if you typed the questions. That way I can read them out and have a record. But if you'd like to speak, just hold your hand up, and I believe he will unmute you. That's another option too.
Thanks, Ray. I will moderate the question and answers. And also, Ray, if you want, I can read out the questions that are typed. But if you have the window open, if you can see the questions relatively easily, then feel free to answer them as they come in. So as you can see, there have been no written questions yet. And I just want to let the audience know that there is a little bit of a delay. So once an answer is asked, it may take a little bit of time, a couple seconds, before Dr. Deonanand can respond. Of course, if anyone has a question that they would like to ask Dr. Deonanand audially, I don't even know if that's a word, but I can unmute you and you can certainly ask your question. So we've got a couple of questions, some raised hands. So I'll start with Arjun. I'm just going to unmute you now. Go ahead, Arjun.
Thank you so much for the opportunity. An important slide that I see that by 2030, this burden of disease among the childhood population will be, you know, lot of difference we could see. Then what is the measure, what is the main criteria that we took to determine that transition or that difference in that disease burden?
Okay, thank you very much. The question, if I heard it correctly, was the change from 2004 to 2030 in disease burdens, how is it measured? I didn't hear exactly which disease you're referring to, but I'll talk generally about them all. These graphs were from the WHO, so I'm not sure how they collected it, but these things tend to be collected in a ramshackle, heterogeneous way. Right, usually using data compiled from a variety of different sources, from a variety of different NGOs, sometimes from governments as well. But they're measured in dailies again. And again, it's unclear whether, in fact, it's reliable data. And I guess your question is also, how is a projection done into the future? I don't know. If I was doing it, I would do it based upon population change. So today, for example, we can say that heart disease affects 30% of people of men aged 45 to 65, let's say. And so demographic projections say that that particular age and sex group will constitute, let's say, two-thirds of the population. So we multiply the current rate by the change from the current proportion, two-thirds. That's the way I would do it. It's not really the best way, but it's a way of doing it. So to be honest, I don't know how they did it. There are lots of ways of doing this. Another way of doing it is through, you know, multi-level regression. So I don't know, to answer your question, I don't know.
Thank you.
Thank you for the questions. Good question.
Thank you. Okay.
If you want to know the actual answer, I mean, you can go to the WHO website and just look up changes in dailies until 2030, and the report will come up, and there will be a fine print that describes the methodology.
Okay, so you have a written-in question, Ray, if you want to take a look at that.
I don't see it, so can you read that for me, please?
Sure. Are there specific courses available on global/international health?
There are many courses available on global and international health. The question is where? Right. So in Canada, there are many, many, many programs, and it's a hot topic. So more and more universities are investing in global health programs. So pretty much every epidemiology program will have something resembling a global health class. I am at the University of Ottawa, and each department has something resembling a global health class or program. If you can't find one where you are, write to me, and I'll investigate and see what's available for you. But if you really struggle, there are lots of great free documentaries out there as well. A good one is called Prescription for Survival, I think. It's free on YouTube. We live in this wonderful era of free education. There's so much out there. either on YouTube or through download documentaries. And the top global programs tend to be, in my opinion, Johns Hopkins, Karolinska, LSHTM in England. But again, it depends on where you live. They're guaranteed there's going to be a global health course near you.
Great. So Eliana says thank you for that. Patience John has a question. Can we please have the slides sent? So I think if it's okay with you, Ray, we can send them all a copy of the slides after the webinar, and I'll also send a link to the recording. So that'll be hopefully available in the next 48 hours or so. Jane has a question, so or a comment rather, and a question. Jane asks, "What is this is a really wonderful presentation. I want to ask Dr. Ray Watt, what do you think about the poverty problem related to global health? If we compare the health indicators between poverty population among different areas, we may find there is differential health status. The poverty usually is related to poor sanitation conditions and poor knowledge of self-health maintenance. So is it just the problem of poverty or a problem of knowledge amongst, I guess, poor people?"
Right. Yeah, it's a curious question, and it's a chicken and egg question, right? So what comes first, the poverty or the poor health? And there's obviously going to be some interaction there. Poor health prevents you from advancing in life and probably accelerates your poverty. And but with poverty, we have to be careful to distinguish between individual poverty and societal poverty, right? So Canada is a wealthy nation, but we have poor people here. As a wealthy nation, though, we invest in infrastructure, clean water, controls of pollution, and things like that. And as a result, our poor people are not as unhealthy as, say, a country like Bangladesh, which is a poor country and doesn't have the ability to invest in population health controls. As a result, their poor people are not as healthy as our poor people. But the bigger issue is, you know, is economic depravity the root of poor health? Increasingly, I think that it might be. One of the great gurus of global health is Jeff Sachs, who's an economist. But Jeff Sachs has been saying for a while that the problem really is just poverty. So if you've got enough money, you can buy your way out of it. And obviously, it's not a panacea. If you look at India, India is a good example of this. India, we tried all sorts of development projects in India for decades. It wasn't until they started getting wealthy as a result of structural adjustment in the 90s that suddenly India started seeing dramatic positive change. However, in India, that positive change is not for everybody. So the extremely poor are actually doing worse than they did in the past, and the price of extreme wealth has been ecological degradation. So there's no easy answer. I mean, you asked a good question, and the answer is, of course, there's interactivity between wealth and health, but it's important to separate out societal wealth versus individual wealth. With sufficient societal wealth and good governance, you can invest in population health, and that helps everybody. So the individual doesn't have to be wealthy if the population is wealthy enough and investing properly. Thank you. Good question.
So I hope that answers your question, Jane. Catherine Nicholson asks, could we repeat the YouTube documentary name? So we have a YouTube channel. So if you go to YouTube and you just search CSEB, S-C-E-B, which is our username, that's where it'll be located. We have several other videos available there. But again, I will follow up with everyone on this webinar and send you an email with the slides and the direct link to that video. Okay, so Jerrica Little asks, mental health indicators present a very challenging area of research for those interested in global health, given cultural differences in presentation, understanding, assessment tools, and treatment of psychiatric diseases. Where would an epidemiologist begin in trying to understand mental health issues globally?
Wow, that's a great question. And I'm not an expert on this, unfortunately. I did some work in juvenile mental health many years ago, and no one knows where to start, to be honest. The biggest gap right now, I think, is in surveillance and just understanding the prevalence and distribution of some of these issues. But you're absolutely right. The different cultures define poor mental health differently, right? So in some places, you're not mentally ill if you can feed yourself. That's their threshold is quite high. In other countries, a feeling of anxiety might be considered mental health. So a safe answer is you stick to the DSM diagnoses and the ICD-9 codes. But the more complex answer is you must choose a population that you wish to focus on. You can be transnational and say, I'm interested in young people suffering from unipolar depression as a result of PTSD caused by war issues, for example. Or you can say, I'm interested in postpartum depression amongst Arab refugees living in Lebanon. That's specific, because that's really what it comes down to. Or what I think is really useful right now is there are a lot of work being done on using information technology, either through social media or metadata, to see if there's some sort of wisdom around prevalence estimates and clustering that can be extracted almost through proxy measurements. Because measuring the distribution of mental health issues is one of the biggest challenges we're facing right now. But you're absolutely correct. Definition is problematic. And that's always going to be a problem with mental health, is defining what it is you're looking at. And by the way, I think in my experience, one of the best places in Canada to start with this sort of work is in Dalhousie. They have a fairly well-established mental health, global health facility. I believe Dr. Kutcher runs that one.
Great. Jerrica says thank you. And sorry, I just want to say that I misinterpreted Catherine's question. She actually wants to see that link to that documentary that you were referring to in your presentation that's on YouTube. So maybe if you want to go back to that slide, I don't know, or at least they'll have a link to it.
Let me see if I can find it. It's going to be, oops.
Amongst your 80 slides.
Right. It's going to be in the Bretton Woods. Finding it. Here we go. Can you see it?
Yeah. So I think just...
That's the one I assume you're talking about.
I think so. Is that right, Catherine? Yep. She says thanks very much. So I guess while she's writing that link down, there's a question. Arjun has another question, I believe. So Arjun, I'm going to unmute you again. And please, could you try to speak louder so we can all hear? Thank you. Go ahead, Arjun.
Thank you so much. I would like to add in the same topic that we already discussed, that economic versus health situation. I think the educational level also determines the health status of a community or state in general. For example, I would like to give example from India again, the Kerala, where the education level, that literacy rate is more than 98%, and eventually because of that, the epidemiologists say because of that education level, the mortality rate, child morbidity, mortality rate, everything, these indicators are in a very good position.
Kerala is an interesting example.
Yeah.
It's a famous example. It's considered the miracle of development. If people don't know anything about Kerala, it's a state in India where everything went well. But here's the problem. There are so many other factors involved in Kerala, not just literacy rates. There's heavy investments in social welfare and in public hygiene. And also, there's a lot of money coming, there used to be a lot of money coming in from the Gulf states, back when a lot of Kerala workers were being hired in the Persian Gulf and sending back remittance payments. The remittance economy in Kerala was secretly funding a lot of the development there. So the economists have a hard time disentangling whether or not the miracle of Kerala had to do with the investment in the people, or whether or not it had to do with all this extra money coming in from the Persian Gulf. Now, the money stopped coming after 9/11, and Carol has kind of slipped back in its development status. So it's a little confusing. To answer your question, obviously nobody knows for sure, but it's not as straightforward as just literacy.
Oh, okay.
I had more time in this presentation, I would have brought up the demographic transition, the factors that affect demographic transition. Among them are our education. But yeah, so all these factors are in play. Excellent question. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
So maybe a phase two webinar for you, all right?
Sure.
So there's a question from Kurt that's written in. How do you make sure disease prevalence and incidence data tracked over the years is not subjected to detection bias?
Wow, that's a really good question. And you can't really. In my experience, it all is subjected to detection bias. And you just can't use, you have to use it sparingly and with a wise eye. I'll give you an example. I was on a project once in a South American country, and the project implementation plan used the indicator of number of cases of HIV as their indicator of success. So in 5 years time, we'll have fewer cases of HIV. The problem is the project also included a component of increasing that country's capacity to test for HIV. So on the one hand, their educational component of the program was going to reduce HIV. On the other hand, the testing component of the program was going to artificially increase HIV because they're going to detect more of them. So the program was set up to fail, right? So almost all international projects are like that. If you don't have a lot of baseline data, everything you do is going to increase your ability to detect issues. And that's going to, you know, bite you in the ass. You set up to fail. No fault of your own. So to answer your question, there is not much you can do except to be wise in how you interpret the information and to always speak sparingly and hesitatingly about the conclusions that you make.
That's great. We're at the 1 o'clock mark right now. So we've got just one question left if you're okay to answer it, Ray,
sure.
Before
no
we
no
log off. But again, for all those who need to log off now, a copy of the recording will be made available to you. So the last question is from Jane again. Jane asks, how would you comment on the advantage and disadvantages of neoliberalism and government leadership for population health promotion? From the international health perspective. I'm sorry, paraphrasing that one.
Wow. That's really interesting. So neoliberalism, it's a dangerous topic. I mean, if you look at cases like China and India, where undeniably neoliberal policies have produced enormous amounts of wealth. On the other hand, has that wealth come at too high of a price? The people that did not, that suffer perhaps from the liberal policies are dead, and they're not present to be counted in the success or the lack of success of the current programs. So the safe answer is to say that neoliberal programs can result in overall societal wealth to the extent that we understand what wealth means, but they must be tempered with additional social programs to support those that may be are not caught up in the overall increases in wealth. Because there's always going to be a sector of society that is held back and may be suffering. So the country where I do a lot of work in Guyana, neoliberal policies have seen incredible gains in infrastructure, but real wages have stayed low. As a result, while there's a lot more stuff in that country, no one can afford it anymore, right? So the neoliberal policies increase the presence of resources, but not the ability of the people to afford those resources. So there is no one pure path. In my opinion, it has to be balanced. It has to be a combination of social intervention and support and business support and economic development.
That's great. Well, thanks, thanks Ray, for that. And I see a few comments from the participants thanking you for the great presentation. On behalf of the CSEB, I'd like to thank everyone for joining us today. Please take the time to answer our evaluation survey, which will be prompted, which you will be prompted to complete at the close of the webinar, as well as in a follow-up email. If you have any questions or concerns regarding this webinar or future webinars of the CSEB, please feel free to email us at secretariat@csEB.ca. So thanks again, Ray, and I'd like to wish everyone a happy, wonderful day.
Thank you. Bye.